Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. In his memoir, A Reason to Believe, Governor Deval Patrick tells a story about one of his first experiences at Milton Academy. Patrick grew up on Chicago's South Side. The prestigious Massachusetts prep school was a world away from where Patrick grew up on Chicago's South Side. For one thing, Milton Academy had a dress code.
So when the clothing list arrived at home, my grandparents splurged on a new jacket for me to wear. But a jacket on the South Side of Chicago is a windbreaker. So the first day of class, when all the other boys were putting on their blue blazers and their tweed coats, I had my windbreaker. But I figured it out.
Yes, he did. He also figured out Harvard, corporate America, federal government, and state government. Though he still got some figuring there left to do, with a fierce debate over union bargaining power, balancing the state budget, and what steps he'll take next after this, his second and last term as Massachusetts governor.
Today on Radio Boston, we'll talk about all of those issues. And later in the show, the governor will be taking your calls. So give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK.
Well, joining us now in the studio is Governor Deval Patrick. His new book is A Reason to Believe, Lessons from an Improbable Life. Governor Patrick, welcome back to Radio
Boston. Thank you for having me.
It's really a delight to have you back. You
know, it's a little weird to have a recording of my own voice played while I'm sitting right here, you know.
We feel it every day, so tell me about it. But, you know, I wanted to actually start out with that story that you tell about the dress code and Milton Academy and sort of having to figure it out, because it seems very emblematic of your life, that yours is one of a procession of having to figure things out in constantly new and unexpected situations. So what do you think it is about you that, you know, enabled you to figure things out when maybe, say, others haven't?
What a great question. Well, I think that there are, in many ways, examples in the book of my having to figure it out in new and ever more challenging settings. And I think what I learned early on is that I was capable of figuring it out, and it was kind of fun to be in a setting that was unfamiliar and where you could try new things. I mean, Milton at the time, and I write about this in the book, Meghna, was a place where, as between my life there and my life at home on the South Side of Chicago, each community made me feel like rejection of the other was the price of acceptance. And I had to come to understand that that was a false choice, that what I had to sort out is who I am, what my values were, and to be that all the time. And that was what was going to enable me to move from one place to another and to live in this broader world.
But figuring out that was a false choice, it didn't come easy, and
it didn't
come early to your life either.
Right.
I mean, you were a high schooler at Milton Academy. So, and you actually had to face kind of a similar set of others. Even when you were growing up on the South Side, because on the South Side of Chicago, you yourself, and you tell a great story about this in the book, about how you were considered, you know, for example, not black enough.
Well, my father...
How is that possible, first of all?
My father had very strong feelings about that in terms of my experience at Milton. That's what I write about. He thought that my being at Milton Academy was a terrible idea, because he thought it would mean I would let my guard down. I would, as a young black man, that I would end up being, as he put it, not black enough. At home, I write in the book about a first visit home after the first semester away, and talking with my sister and my grandparents, and my sister interrupting and saying, "Ooh," she said, "he talks like a white boy." And my mother, and I was devastated. And my grandmother shot back, "He speaks like an educated boy," and sort of saved the day. But that was emblematic of that, of feeling like you were straddling these two worlds at the time.
You know, your book is very much sort of a constellation of people who were important and influential to you in your life. And I'm wondering if we can sort of talk about some of those stars in particular. Mm. First of all, with your grandmother, tell us a little bit about her. I found her to be kind of a surprising person.
Well, she was a fascinating person. I sometimes slip into the present tense because she is still very much with me. She was the daughter of a white Irish landowner in Kentucky and his black charwoman. She grew up in Kentucky. She married my grandfather there in Kentucky, whose father I knew growing up. He died in 1965, 2 days short of his 100th birthday. So he would have been born in Kentucky in 1865, a black man. I mean, amazing array of stories you can imagine. But anyhow, my grandmother and my grandfather moved to Chicago in the 30s, and started their family. And she was she had very middle class aspirations. She stayed home. She looked after the house. She managed the tenement building that we lived in as a way to get a break on the rent. And my grandfather worked several jobs. And she was really a presence. Everything from the kind of Betty Crocker, I'm dating myself here, but the sort of Betty Crocker middle class presence of a woman at home who bakes cakes every Saturday to somebody who could gossip with the best of them and curse like you wouldn't believe.
But learned curses, as you said.
Some of it, yes, yes. I remember I remember she once described somebody, can I say this on the air? Maybe not.
I guess we're going to find out.
Anyway.
Probably not. Let's not take a chance.
Some very creative ways of talking about people.
Well, I mean, the thing about that I found most sort of moving about your grandmother is that you said, in part because of, quite frankly, how she looked. She had almost reddish hair and was pretty fair skin.
Right.
So it was she was light enough essentially to pass.
Right.
And so even, you know, through her at a young age, you had these experiences of kind of moving or the aspirations of moving between worlds and the challenges there.
She was very much she was very much a black woman, and that was how she thought of herself. That's where she lived and how she moved in the world. But she would tell stories about traveling around in the South with my grandfather and my mother and her brother, and how she would go into the diner first and sit down at a table and order, and then call the rest of the family in once the food was served, because frequently it was more awkward for the proprietor to tell them to leave if the food was already on the table. And there's one story in particular she was very proud of where they tried that, and the proprietor said, nonetheless, no, you know, we'd be happy to serve you, but you're going to have to eat in the kitchen. And her response was, we don't eat in the kitchen in our own home. And they stormed out and left the food on the table.
When you first heard that story, how old were you? Do you remember?
Gosh, I'd probably 9.
Mm-hmm. And as a 9-year-old, how did that sit with you?
Well, you know, it's a... When I was growing up, as I write in the book, we would go home to my grandparents, to visit my grandparents' family in Louisville, Kentucky, once a month. And that was a long drive from Chicago into the South. And they went out of their way to make sure we weren't exposed to the worst of those times in the 50s and the 60s. You know, we'd pack food, there were all kinds of strategies about going to the bathroom and what have you. We would always go for Derby weekend, for example, in May, and always into the infield. And I thought that was just the better place to view it and all that. I didn't know that for a period of time, that's the only place where blacks could go. Mm-hmm. to the Derby. So a lot of it, you know, what my grandparents were trying to do, I know what my grandparents were trying to do was not to... they wanted me to know the world, but not be bitter about the world, not to be exposed or limited in my own imagination about the world and its own possibilities. And I think in retrospect, they went to great lengths, and I try to describe some of those in the book.
You know, also in the book, about that home environment, when you and your mother and sister had to move in with your grandparents, mm-hmm. you write, and this is a quote from the book, you write that the focus on our home seemed to be inordinately on table manners, respectfulness, and homework, not poverty, deprivation, or social justice. Looking back, I mean, are you glad that that's where the focus was and maybe not sort of reminding you of these bigger systemic issues that we're facing, you
know, all African Americans? It's interesting. You know, it's glad or not, it's the way it was. It's I hope what you took away from the book and other readers will is something more descriptive than judgmental, if you know what I mean. I think that, you know, my wife and I in raising our children have tried to make sure our kids are aware of the world around them, and I think that that was something that that my grandparents were trying to get across to my sister and me as well, without our being either afraid of it or daunted by it, or as I said earlier, embittered by
mm-hmm.
it.
It's actually interesting to me how you talk a little bit in detail about your time at Milton Academy, mm-hmm. but then, you know, as people know, you went to Harvard University, but you spend just a few pages on Harvard. Why is that?
Well, I had a wonderful experience at Harvard. I didn't mean to give it short shrift, but there were, you know, the book is not so much a kind of a blow-by-blow here's what happened, and then here's what happened next. It really is a series of lessons that I'm trying to tell from my own experience about that have made me the optimistic, frankly, idealistic person I am. And I've come to recognize those qualities as strengths, Meghna. And what I want to do through the book is to show that any of us has the opportunity to pass those kinds of lessons on to another. Many of the folks I talk about, or some I talk about in the book, were completely anonymous. They weren't people whose names I knew. The bus driver I described at the beginning of the book.
Who
told me to pass it on. And I think, you know, we are having that kind of impact on people all the time in our daily lives, each of us. And I'd like for myself to be more intentional about that.
Well, one of the people who has had an impact on your life, maybe in part because of his absence, is your father.
Yes.
We had a listener on our Facebook page actually want me to ask you this question. He wants to know about your father, and the person asks, I read that you, Governor Patrick, seldom saw him even when you grew into an adult, which is when your father toured the East Coast because he was a musician. So for people who don't know who your father is, first, why don't you go ahead and remind us?
So my father was a jazz musician. He was a founding member of an avant-garde group called Sun Ra, which people who follow jazz know. Look at Anthony over there.
I'm a big Sun Ra fan. I had no idea.
So he played with Sun Ra for 30 years. He played with just about everybody, with Duke and Count Basie. He loved Thelonious Monk. He recorded with him Mongo Santa Maria. He was a very accomplished
tenor sax
musician. He was best known for baritone, but he played all the reeds, most of the winds, actually all of the winds, I think, strings, keyboard. He was a real virtuoso. But he and my mother split when I was four, and I didn't see very much of him for those early years after I was four. I saw more of him when I got to Milton Academy, because by then he was living in New York. So when he wasn't touring, we were closer together and could see more of each other. But we had a really tortured relationship for a lot of the time when I was growing up, again because he was so disapproving of my time at Milton. He was convinced, wrongly, that my mother was poisoning my sister and me about him and his life and his life's choices and so forth, and that we didn't appreciate his music and his dedication to his music. We had a wonderful reconciliation, or what I should properly describe as the start of a reconciliation, on my 25th birthday, mm-hmm. which I write about in the book. And then when Diane and I were engaged, and they had an opportunity to meet in New York, and they took to each other immediately, and she had a lot to do with bringing him back into my life.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Wow. Well, you know, I mean, there's actually, within the story of your father, there's so much more to talk about. I'm going to run out of time in our conversation about your bio here, and there's just a couple more people, at least one more that I want to get to, because you kind of, in a way, found a father figure.
Yes. A couple of them.
And the one that really caught my attention was one of your teachers at Milton Academy, A.O. Smith.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about him.
So he was right out of Central Casting, right? He was he was this wizened character, kind of thin with a buzz cut, reminiscent of his time in the RAF in the 1940s in the Second World War. He was from an old money New England family. He had a great, big, beautiful antique house in Milton and another place down on the Cape, and he was the first person to ever take me to the Cape and show me that part of this extraordinary commonwealth.
Well, and it's that story that I want to highlight a little, because you write in the book, A Reason to Believe, that on that first weekend at the house in South Orleans, as A.O. Smith was, you know, sort of going from room to room, telling his own children goodnight, you know, he'd follow up the goodnights with, you know, saying, I love you. And then he basically did the same to you. He said, goodnight, and I love you. And that moment really, really mattered to you. Why?
Well, it was the first time any man had told me that he loved me. My father had never said it. My grandfather had never said it. Now, they did, in fact, but my grandfather was a very Victorian sort of character, my grandparents for that matter, and so they weren't open in that way. And my father, I think, hadn't quite figured out that yet, how to express himself. And as I say, we hadn't spent much time with each other, and it was just so natural and offhand almost, but startling for me. And there were so many elements of that first weekend down on the Cape, which I write about in the book, that have had a lasting impression on me, including just the nature of their hospitality, which was just their interest in me and having me tell my stories. And all I wanted to do, in fact, was just listen to him, because he's still, I think, probably the most fluent English speaker I'd ever met.
Well, the other thing is that you write, quote, I think my desire to emulate A.O., his emotional candor, his generosity of spirit started then and there. And the reason why that line really sort of made me step back is because in your political career in Massachusetts here, you've spoken quite frequently about that, about the need for candor and generosity of spirit in sort of how we go about governing. But on the other hand, you know, you find yourself in this political life in a world, politics, that, you know, a lot of people look to and say those two qualities, emotional candor and generosity of spirit, are exactly the things that are missing. So has that been a challenge for you, trying to wed those values to the reality of politics?
It has been a challenge. It's, for one thing, you know, even when you are, and this is, I suppose, part of the risk you take whenever you are emotionally candid, that people don't accept it. You know, they question whether it's authentic. They question whether it's appropriate. There's a tremendous amount of percentage we give to hard-headedness in public life. And, you know, I understand about balancing budgets and making the tough calls and so forth, and had to do it every single year and have done it every single year I've been in office. But I think if you don't see if you don't see the people behind the line items, if you don't see the and care about and work for the unmet needs of the citizenry, then you're missing a part of what the job is about.
You know, we've got to take a break here in just about a minute, and I'll hand over the reins to Anthony then. But
he's been very quiet, hasn't he?
He was raised right, too.
It hasn't been easy, Governor.
but Governor, I just wanted to sort of wrap up my portion here by asking you, you know, the subtitle of your book is Lessons from an Improbable Life. And perhaps, you know, for a young African-American man growing up in the 60s, much of your life was improbable, going from Chicago South Side, Milton, Harvard, to the biggest boardrooms in America, and to the governorship. But I wonder if you think today, for maybe the young Deval Patricks out there, is such a path equally improbable today? And
great
if so,
question.
What does that mean for how far we have or haven't come?
I think that my story is a quintessentially American story. And while it doesn't get told as often as we'd like in this country, it gets told more often in this country than any other place on earth. And I think that, meaning the ability to imagine a different way, a different place for yourself, and then to work toward it. And one of my biggest concerns right now, in this moment, is that in the minds and in the realities of an awful lot of people, the American dream is up for grabs. And to me, when the president, you remember a couple weeks ago, the president laid out his deficit reduction plan, mm-hmm. and he talked about how the real question is what kind of country you want to live in. I think that's exactly where the conversation belongs, and I think that's what we've fundamentally been fussing about for a long time now. We talk about it as if it's policy, but there really is a basic question: are we going to encourage and enable the kind of society that where people can move from where they are to a different place with the right tools and the right education?
Well, we've got to take a short break, but when we come back, Anthony will pick up the conversation about what kind of commonwealth we want to live in.
Thank you.
And your influence on that, including union bargaining rights in the state budget. And you mentioned President Barack Obama, maybe your role in the race in 2012. We'll also be taking your calls, listeners. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Governor Deval Patrick is our guest today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, along with Anthony Brooks. We'll be right back after a quick break. This is Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And we're back with Governor Deval Patrick. We've been talking to him about his memoir, A Reason to Believe. From this point on, we're going to talk some politics, some public policy, and we're going to take your call. So give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Governor Patrick, good to have you here.
And good to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for doing so. Let me just jump right in. Big news story, of course, the killing of Osama bin Laden. State House News Service reported today that you held a briefing with your security team about possible threats. What can you tell us about that briefing, how the state is responding to this news?
Well, yesterday we got together the leadership from public safety, from the National Guard, state police, the T police as well, emergency management, just to check in. There is no new or concerning intelligence, but I think everyone is and should be should have heightened awareness and sensitivity to the possibility of retaliation. So that if you've been on the T or at the airport, for example, you will notice more visibility for the time being from our security apparatus and personnel. But as I say, no new information. It's really an excess of caution.
Sure. 10 years after 9/11, are you confident that our airports, seaports, trains, the T, all these potential targets are secure? Maybe a fair question. Are we safer than we were 10 years ago?
We are definitely much more vigilant and much more sophisticated about security today than we were 10 years ago. There is some inconvenience that goes with that, of course, but I think most people understand it, and we've been working hard, not just here in Massachusetts, but really all around the country, to lessen that inconvenience and strike the right balance with security.
I want to move on before we take a couple of calls, and let's talk about this proposed budget and particularly this vexing, controversial issue about collective bargaining. As you know, the House approved a $30.5 billion budget. The Senate has yet to take that up.
Right.
Among the provisions, a weakening of collective bargaining for rights for municipal workers. It would allow local officials to set insurance copays and deductibles.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, labor leaders call this an assault on collective bargaining. Are they right? Will you sign a budget bill that includes that provision?
Well, I don't think the provision is going to end up where it is right now, but there's something that has to happen in terms of municipal health care costs. It is separate and apart from the question of driving health care costs down throughout mm-hmm. the whole system, which we are working on. This is not that solution, but a rebalancing of who pays what share is a fair question to ask. And it's something, by the way, that labor here in Massachusetts has been very engaged in with me over the last couple of years. We took some steps, you may remember, Anthony, some of your listeners will, to enable municipal employees to come into the state health insurance program, which is a lower cost health care program. A number of communities did. The threshold for doing that is high. Then it takes, I think the threshold today is 70%. Of union votes. We know we have to do something that brings more communities in fact, all communities in it, or to something as cost-effective. because we are not able to keep up with the local aid.
So, long way around to
answer your question. It's interesting because I was in Wisconsin on Saturday, and they were all wound up about it there as well, because some of the rhetoric has been that this is Wisconsin all over again.
Well,
this
in fact,
is not
it was
Wisconsin.
The Republican Party of Wisconsin. They're obviously trying to tweak your nose. They proclaimed you an ally on this issue because of this vote in the House.
They made a big mistake there. But, but this is not that. You know, you should know that here in Massachusetts, we have reformed the pension system, the transportation bureaucracy. We've done education reform. We've done some reforms already in healthcare, and in every one of those cases, labor has been at the table. Hmm. And in order to do this, and for me to have a bill that I will sign, it has to both deliver real results, real savings to cities and towns, so we can maintain as many municipal services as possible, and have a meaningful role for labor.
Well, let's get some calls in, because already our lines are full. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Brockton with a question about unions. Hi, Michael. You're on the air with Governor Patrick.
Hi, Michael.
Governor, thank you. I probably have that green button from your first foray into the governorship sitting above my desk.
Thank you.
And I would just like to say, obviously, I think you know what you need to do in terms of tackling this issue with the entitlements and so forth. But let me just say this: from your first year, as I watched your vetoes and so forth. Of the budget, you were overridden more than Romney was, and I find that curious, first of all. And then let me just say this before I hang up. When I listened to your acceptance speech and you talked about your uncle, and I turned to a buddy of mine next to me, Ozzie Jordan, who, if it weren't for politics, we wouldn't even talk to each other. We both said, my God, this man has lived what you and I as city kids lived growing up. And I admire that about you, and I really respect everything you're trying to do. And God bless you. I'm just going to hang up and listen to what you have to say.
Michael, thank you. I think I just maybe pick a point there. I don't think I've been overridden more than Romney. In fact, I don't think I've been overridden much at all on budget issues, because frankly, there's not a lot of latitude, right? We are. I want to say a public and sincere thank you to the legislature for working with us through some really awful fiscal times. But unlike a lot of other states, our budgets have been responsible, balanced, and on time every single year.
Michael, thanks for that call. Let me move on to another subject before we get back to the calls, and that is your friendship, your support of President Obama. Mm-hmm. I understand you'll be playing a role in supporting his reelection. Let me ask you sort of about where he stands with the public. A poll that just came out today showed that, not surprisingly, the killing of Osama bin Laden gave him a sizable bump. But the top issue by far, the handling of the economy, only 40% of Americans in this latest Washington Post poll approve.
Mm-hmm.
That's the lowest of his presidency. What's your analysis of why so few Americans have confidence in the way the president is handling the
economy?
You
know, you must know you're asking the wrong guy. I mean, ask Megna, she will tell you. I just don't pay a lot of attention to the polls.
Sure.
I think that the president may benefit from the campaign for reelection in some of the same ways that I did, in this sense, Anthony. The campaign requires that you have that you go through the discipline of thinking about your narrative and then telling that story. You know, connecting up the different things you've done and the results that it has produced, so that you find you're not running against yourself. You're really about a mission. And I think that it was really useful for me to have to go through the experience of reelection, because, you know, it gave us a minute to step back and say, wait a second, we're first in the nation in student achievement, in healthcare coverage, in veteran services, in clean energy initiatives. We're growing jobs faster than 45 other states. That's not by accident. That's because of choices that we've been making. Well, nationally, This is the president who pulled the economy back from the brink of full-blown depression. We have the largest energy bill in the history of the United States inside the stimulus bill. You know, we've healthcare reform has been passed after 90 years of trying. Happens to be modeled on our model here in Massachusetts, and it's been wildly successful here on a lot of levels. Sure, there's more to be done, but there's a narrative there that I think the White House and the reelect, most importantly, and the president will develop, not make up, but really just connect up things that they've been doing. And I think that'll turn out to be good for the president as well as the reelection campaign.
Certainly part of that narrative that the president is going to have to respond to, and I actually want to get you to respond to this, is there's a liberal critique of the president that's been growing.
That feels very familiar.
Okay, well, we'll respond to this, that he gives in too easily. For example, in the debate over health care reform, which you just mentioned, he gave up too easily, according to this critique, on the public option. In the budget negotiations, Republicans, he went back on his promise to end the Bush tax cut for the richest Americans. Shutting down Guantanamo, he's not shutting it down. These issues really anger liberals.
These are
liberals.
Serious. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say, these issues really anger liberals. And is that criticism fair, or is the president smart to move toward the center on these issues?
Well, I mean, some of those issues are my issues too. You know, at the time, for example, of the debate around extending the tax cuts, which is, as you know, the president has said will not be extended again. I was one of the folks who believed that as a part of our response to the deficit, we should go on and end them. But at the time he made that promise, we didn't have a global economic collapse, and there were economists saying that, yes, we should end the tax cuts, but now was not the time to end those tax cuts. So, you know, I understand that from the president's point of view, he is getting lots of substantive policy advice, not just political advice. And I think that sometimes those of us on the left are sometimes not just those of us on the left, those of us who are watching and evaluating the politics are reacting to the politics and not changes in circumstances that may affect the substance. It's above all important that we get that right. I believe in conviction politics. I believe that we should say what we believe and be willing to lose if that's what we believe. And so I think the folks who say that, well, the president is tacking to the middle and all that sort of thing for political purposes may actually be missing both who this president is and what he is trying to do.
Let's try to get through some of these calls. There are a lot of them out there. Brenda, who's calling from Draycott. Hi, Brenda. You're on the air with Governor Deval Patrick.
Thanks, Anthony. And hello, Governor.
Hi, Brenda.
How are you today?
I'm okay. How are you?
Good. I'm doing good. I actually am a public service faculty member at Suffolk, and I see so many professionals and students who are entering into public service or who have been working in public service for a long time who have a lot of passion and a lot of interest in, you know, trying to really tackle the problems that we have today.
Yes.
But what I worry about is that they face a significant pressure from, you know, not the whole public, but the public about a distrust in government.
Yes.
And people who are very disengaged. And so when we are trying to really help folks succeed and really contribute, they're up against such tremendous forces there's just this whole idea of corrupt government and lack of productivity and performance. And so I guess the question I have is, so how do we engage people so that they're more aware of how complex it is to run government, but also to help people think about what their role is?
Yes.
It's not just government's role entirely, but I think we have to do a better job, and I would love to hear you talk a little bit about that in terms of what you see now and what you see in the future.
Brenda, great question.
Brenda,
Governor,
I feel it's a really important question and important observation. I remember, I think it was a year and a half ago, we had these, it might be 2 years now, we had these terrible spring rains and the floods, remember? Mm-hmm. And I remember going out to Waltham where there was a dam that was at risk of breaching. And it was really cold and the rain was pouring down and this water was just, it was like nothing anybody who knew this. I think it was on the Charles River, actually, in Waltham. Nothing anybody had seen in their lifetimes. And this fellow who worked in the dam inspection unit in state government tied himself to a lifeline and crawled out on that dam in these raging, frigid waters to try to remove the pins to let some of the pressure from behind the dam loose so it would not breach the dam and wouldn't cause damage down the downstream. And I remember saying to the camera and the medias who were there, I said, you know what, the next time you run a story on state government, show that image. Because I see versions of that every day. It is absolutely, it is disappointing, let me put it that way, that so many teachers today who are the single most important ingredient in a successful education are feeling like education reform is about them, about what they're not doing, about what, you know, that if we just fire all the teachers
and
start over. As opposed to poverty,
mm-hmm.
Which is the single biggest problem in our achievement gap. Overall, we do fabulously, but we still have kids stuck in the achievement gap, and overwhelmingly they are poor, or kids who don't speak English as a first language, or I think that we have Brenda's right, a tremendous amount of work to do to come back to this sense that government is not some abstraction out there. It's not them. It's us. It's just the name we give, as Barney Frank likes to say, to the things we choose to do together.
Hmm. Let me ask you a question about the budget that has been approved by the House, going to be taken up by the Senate. Obviously, there are going to be some difficult choices here, and let me ask you about one. Today, it's being reported the Department of Public Health is notifying workers that due to the budget proposal, they'll have to lay off some 50 people.
Right.
And the concern here is that some of the work that these folks are involved in is directly related to controlling medical costs.
Yes.
And many of the programs are involved would do just that.
Right.
So these are very painful cuts. How do you sort of describe how these are necessary and make sense of them?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that the budget's not over.
Sure.
It's not done. It's a process. The House has done what they need to do, and there's a lot to like in the House budget. This is a particular choice the House made that I don't like, and we'll be working with the Senate to try to get that fixed. This is the kind of budget, and these are the kinds of times, as you know, Anthony, and your listeners will as well, that if you add something over here, you have to take it away over there. There's not a room full of cash somewhere where we can just make it all right. I think the good things about the House budget are acceptance of our proposal to invest again in K-12 education, which is key,
mm-hmm.
In early education, which is key, and there's some strategies we have to help out in higher education, which are also important. And these things, you know, a lot of public spending is such where you spend it now, you spend it later. If you don't make the investment in trying to control healthcare costs, well, then you spend it later in higher healthcare costs. And we need to be doing the kinds of things today, making the kinds of investments today that leave the Commonwealth stronger over time. That's the generational responsibility, and that's a difference in how Tim Murray and I are trying to govern.
Let's get a call from Gina, who's calling from Lexington. Hi, Gina.
Hi, thanks so much. It's an honor to be a part of this conversation.
Thank you for calling.
Governor Patrick, I really appreciate what you said about the achievement gap just now, and I am a public school teacher in a suburb. We have a METCO program, and I spend a lot of time and energy trying to work against the achievement gap. And I just wonder if you could say something about how you think your own educational experience and amazing success as a student shaped your views to and your approach to the achievement gap.
So, Gina, thank you for the question, and thank you for your service as well. I think that, you know, we have a lot to be proud of after 18 years of of being on this path of education reform in terms of students' overall achievement. As I say, we are first in the nation and have been for each of the last 5 years. We are, I think, third in the world now on the TIMSS measure of math and science, which is great news. But we are still leaving a lot of kids behind who are stuck in that achievement gap, and they tend to be poor. They tend to be kids with special needs, kids who speak English as a second language, and a disproportionate number of kids of color. And I think that is not just an educational and an economic issue, it's a moral issue, especially to let the achievement gap go for so long. And to my personal experience, I know from growing up on the South Side of Chicago that there were lots of kids just as imaginative, just as creative, who may have had a little less discipline in their own homes and lives, but who would, with the right opportunities in school, would have been just as successful. So what I'm looking for, and what the Achievement Gap Bill I signed last year is about, is giving schools and teachers tools to meet the kids where they are, on the understanding that the solution is not the same for every child and in every school. So I went to a school. Do you mind if I go on a little bit?
Sure, go ahead. I want to ask you one more question, though, so do wrap it up, but please.
Okay, let me try to wrap it up quickly.
Thank you.
I visited a school called, I think it was the Orchard Garden School in Boston. I don't know if you've been out or heard about Orchard Gardens, but Orchard Gardens was, as they described it there, the school that in Boston they said no matter how bad things were in the school, they would say at least we're not Orchard Gardens. Orchard Gardens is a turnaround school. They're using every one of the tools from the Achievement Gap Bill. 80% of the faculty is new because the new principal asked them to re-up, and a whole bunch of them said, well, this new mission, we're not quite down with that. We're going to try something else. So he had to recruit a whole bunch of new faculty members. He's extended the school day by an hour and a half, and added art and exercise in that time. He's brought in City Year to help with the after-school program and to chase the kids who are who may not be showing up on time. And so there's all this stuff happening. And their results have improved, on a whole bunch of measures, 60-70% in 6 or 7 months. Why? Because they're getting out of the way of the relationship between a motivated teacher and those individual students. It makes all the difference in the world.
So I want to stick with that theme, and we literally have you're only going to have like 20 seconds to answer this, but it just seems like when it comes to education and figuring out what works, it comes down to individual teachers, one great principal, I feel like we haven't yet figured out sort of the system.
That is the answer. That is the answer. And by the way, there's not just one great principal or one great teacher.
No, but
there.
I mean, a great school has a great principal.
Yes, and there are a lot of them. Is my point. And there's much, much more magic happening in the district schools than they get credit for. And one of the things we need to do is lift that up. Mm-hmm. And then just as we want to lift up what works really well in the successful charter schools, and then let people see what those examples of success are so that they can model it.
Well, Governor Deval Patrick, thanks so much for coming in today. We appreciate
it. Thank you for having me.
It's a real pleasure. That's Governor Deval Patrick. He's the author of A Reason to Believe, Lessons from an Improbable Life. And we're going to be coming back shortly, so stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is Radio Boston.